Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Economist.
In London, this is The Economist. I'm Anne McElvoy, senior editor, and you're listening to The Economist Asks. This week we ask, how can we become more effective and productive without becoming miserable automatons? With me to discuss that is Charles Duhigg, who's recently published his book, Smarter, Faster, Better, and Kenneth Cookier here at The Economist, who reviewed the book for us. Now, Charles, your book is filled with a very generous mix of anecdotes from businesses, from Google to Disney, but also from personal lives and the way that people have made themselves more focused. What got you into the subject in the first place?
Well, it came about because I sort of was personally struggling with the basic question at the core of this, which is I felt like I was running faster and faster and faster to get things done and yet falling farther and farther behind. And it occurred to me that this isn't how life is supposed to work, right? We're living in this age where we have all these gadgets and devices and things are supposed to become more and more utopian. And yet it seems like the more time we spend on email and the more time we are successful, the more it tends to overtake our lives. And I felt like there were these people who were more productive, who seemed to get more done with less stress and less strife and less anxiety. And I wanted to figure out why.
So why?
Well, it turns out, after talking to researchers and to a lot of those people themselves, that the most productive people, they tend to make slightly different choices than the rest of us. And in particular, they tend to build systems in their lives that force themselves to think just half an inch deeper about what the right goals are, what their priorities are, how they motivate themselves, how they maintain their focus. There's so much of life now that pushes us to be reactive. The most productive people tend to be ones who try and push back a little bit and who tend to systematize pushing back so that they have habits that allow them to make the choices that are important to them instead of everyone else.
Now, I'm interested that you say systematize, because some people may say, well, I recognize that, but I also recognize my limits and I'm someone who needs a lot of stimulus to get tasks done. If I try to think about my future job in 5 years, I get panicky. I'd rather just do what the boss wants this week or this month. How much of it is character and how much of it can we relearn?
I think we can relearn all of it. So recognizing what we need to be successful is a huge part of this, because you're exactly right. There are some people who feel like they get energy from others. There's others who get energy from being alone and contemplative. But the point is that learning what kind of person you are, conducting experiments with your own life and seeing your choices as experiments where you can learn from the data that comes out, this is incredibly important. Because
Give me an example. What's this like in practice? it all sounds a bit whiffly. What's it like in practice?
Well, okay, so here's one of my favorite examples, which is that whenever one of our friends decides to get married, it's very natural for us to say, oh, tell me about, you know, how did you propose? How did you know that it was time to get married? What's it like planning the marriage? What we don't do is when one of our friends is getting divorced is say, oh, tell me about the divorce. When did you decide to get divorced? How are you going to go down to the court and get the papers filed? We tend to look at these positive events and see them as binary outcomes, that it's either a success or a failure, that it's inevitable that we end up with a spouse that we're with. But the truth of the matter is that most of life is a distribution, right? The person I married is great for me, but maybe there would have been 5 people who were a little bit better. Maybe there were 10 people who were a little bit worse. And by asking myself, taking a moment to contemplate, could I have made different decisions? What did I learn from these decisions in terms of what was right and what was wrong? Forcing myself to realize who I actually am, that gives me the tools to be productive.
Ken Cookier, there's Charles telling us how to get married. What about application to the workplace? What leapt out of the book for you that we might put into our working lives?
Well, I think that this idea of, in effect, mental models that you would apply, whether it is how you would fly an aircraft or how you would imagine a strategy working out, and to build on what Charles is saying about this Bayesian, in effect, distribution of outcomes, you can actually weigh these possible outcomes. So when you think about the strategy that you're working on, say, or the assignment you're working on in your work, you can imagine that it's going to be successful or not, but it's usually that's not how it actually turns out. It's degrees of success or degrees of failure. And if you think about the variety of different potential outcomes and weigh the activity that you put into it into the likelihood of it being more successful or less successful, you'll probably make better decisions.
So how would I know if I undertook that experiment, question to both of you, that I'm not simply relying on learned behavior, habit, that strange, hard-to-grasp thing that we call character or personality? How would I know that I was able to refine these decisions?
Well, I think two ways. I think the first one is to recognize that the definition of productivity, defining it, is an important part of being productive, right? Is forcing people to say, what actually is productive in my own life? Because we know that a productive morning on a Wednesday might mean dropping your kids off at school and getting to the office as fast as possible, whereas a productive Friday might mean taking a light, nice walk with them to school and having a long chat. But I think the second part to your question is forcing some type of devices of contemplation into people's lives. You know, it used to be that you could spend a lot of time being bored while you're standing online. Now we have smartphones. And so as a result, you're never bored standing online. But you've lost something by losing that boredom. People who find ways to force themselves to listen to podcasts or to have conversations with colleagues or to write letters to friends, they're forcing contemplation devices into their lives to think a little bit more deeply about what do I actually want to get done instead of what is just life pressing me to do.
Ken, when you reviewed the book, where did you think there might be some challenges or some loopholes there for Charles to address?
Well, generally, I thought it was excellent because the stories were so compelling and because there were so many of these tidbits that one could apply. So one could apply, in a sense, all of it. It was all very useful. But there was two maybe shortcomings to the book, or disappointments, minor ones, of course. The first one was that I didn't see the cohesiveness among these eight different features of being smarter, faster, better. And I thought that was a missed opportunity because clearly there are some of these cross connects. Secondly, if it is true that we can become so much more effective by these marginal gains of just getting a little bit, thinking a little bit more deeply at every increment, then we're going to see a big societal change in terms of inequalities in society when you have some of these ubermensches who are more better at focusing and motivation and thinking of the world in a Bayesian statistical distributionary way, and others who aren't, who haven't read the book. And so what do we do about that? And the book was sadly silent on those two points.
I think both of those are very fair. And I think at its core, a lot of this comes down to how do we spread the education around these insights, right? We're living through this golden age of understanding the psychology and the neurology of how our brain works. And as Ken has written very eloquently, of using big data to find insights that we haven't been able to really see before. And the uneven distribution of that has to do with what groups are availing themselves of this knowledge and which groups are being excluded, not through malice, but simply because as societies, we aren't saying that we need to press this into schools. We need to press this into how we're teaching parents to parent. And there is a difficult challenge there because we know that there are leaders who have been resistant to taking populations and exposing them to sort of cutting edge learnings. But I do think that's changing. And I will say, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the popularity of the types of books that we're writing right now is that I find that they tend to be less popular among, say, the 1 or 2% and much more popular among the 30%, right? Most of the letters I get are from people who say, I don't read a lot of books, but I read this one and it helped me quit smoking, or it helped me spend more time with my kids. And I think this is one of the mechanisms of democratization of this knowledge.
That's an interesting answer there from Charles, Ken. But what I thought reading the book was that perhaps there's this element of inequality that is worrying us about societies. And if the elites get smarter, faster and better, aren't we building into a problem which we already know exists, which governments struggle with all over the developed world, which is how to deal with a big gap between the expectations and the performance of those at the top and those at the bottom?
Really, what we're talking about can be considered very specialized. How would you actually implement the lessons from Smarter, Faster, Better into school curricula is something that a lot of policy wonks and technocrats are going to have to struggle with. However, I'm optimistic that I think that they will. I think that the world is undergoing a performance revolution. It's been quiet and it's been silent, but we are able to measure more things than ever before. We are able to atomize discrete activities that we do to optimize it and improve it. And by doing so, it means that, in effect, everything is getting better.
But that's within elites.
Well, you know, it's going to trickle down, and it is, because the school curriculums are going to adopt these practices too.
And I'm also not certain that it is among elites. I mean, I don't think that the elites need a lot of coaching to take time to think about what they want to do with their lives, right? We've all gone to these elite university systems that basically indulge you for 4 years to drink as much wine as you want and think about what you want to do with your future. I actually think that what we're seeing right now with the emergence of popular fiction, not just written, but in television shows and in podcasts, is that we're seeing these ideas trickling down to populations that might not be have educational opportunities that indulge their kind of whimsical fantasies, but that say, we're going to design curriculums to allow you to understand how you can shape your own habits, how to think about governing your own mind. I mean, not just our books, but Thinking Fast and Slow. If you look inside colleges right now, if you look inside high schools, they are using these books that are big think books. And in fact, there's a disparagement by the elite of these books because they're so popular. But the reason they're popular is because they're being embraced by a population that previously didn't have access to the luxury of thinking about themselves quite so much.
Full disclosure from both of you, what have you changed about the way you went about your tasks or your life as a result of, in Charles's case, researching the book, and in Ken's case, reading it?
I've actually changed quite a bit. I mean, one of the things that this book really taught me was that I was focusing far too much on being busy and on efficiency and mistaking it for productivity. And that the only way that I was going to get more control over my life was to decide for myself what I wanted productivity to mean, how I worked best, and then to take steps to systematize that contemplation into my life. So now I spend a lot more time.
Come on, then how?
Well, I spend a lot more time talking with my wife about whether we're making the right choices. When I ride the subway in New York every morning, instead of reading anything or looking at my smartphone, I close my eyes. I try and visualize each day and ask myself, like, what do I actually want to get done today? I write my to-do list very differently. These all sound like small.
You still write the list.
I still write the list, but at the top of the list, I put my biggest aspiration, my biggest goal for that week or that month, to remind myself that it's very easy to get trapped in the small minutia. I need to be focused on my goals. I also delete many more emails immediately. But the point being that I've tried to force.
It's amazing we got you on in the first place. Ken, the ever more perfectible Kenneth Cookier, what did you learn from this about how you should go about your working week?
So the review took 3 weeks rather than one to do because I was continually missing the deadlines. And I had to actually confess to the editor that I needed to adopt the principles of the book to actually finish it. It did expose to me a lot of shortcomings in the way that I bounce around the world like random Brownian motion, and that I needed to be more systemic and systematize my life and use checklists and think about it more strategically, which is I'm in the process of doing.
Kenneth Cookier and Charles Duhigg, thank you both very much. You've been listening to The Economist Asks with me, Anne McElvoy, and you can read our review of Smarter, Faster, Better at economist.com. In London, this is The Economist.
The Economist.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.